A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one, and it's not really a prompt. It's a story. He and Anna just escaped a rental situation that went properly sour. Major roof leak. Landlord refused to fix it. They ended up sleeping on couches and then with relatives. Lawyer told them they had a solid case. Breach of obligations. Failure to offer rent reduction. The works. But when it came time to wrap up the tenancy, the landlord, who happens to be a lawyer himself, used their security deposit as leverage and eventually got them to sign a mutual waiver of liability. Daniel's question is essentially, did we do the right thing by walking away? And what do you say to people who feel like they've let the side down by not fighting?
That tension he's describing, between knowing you're legally right and feeling too exhausted to prove it, that's not a personal failing. That's the system functioning exactly as designed. And I think the first thing to say is that Daniel and Hannah made a completely rational decision. They have a 1-year-old son. Moving is already one of the top 5 most stressful life events according to the Holmes Rahi Stress Scale, right up there with divorce and death of a loved one. Adding a small claims case on top of that, while you're still unboxing your kitchen, is a cognitive load most people cannot reasonably bear.
It's not just the moving itself. Think about what their daily life actually looked like during that period. They got a roof leak, which means they're probably setting out buckets and towels every time it rains. They're waking up at 3 in the morning to the sound of water dripping onto their belongings. They're worried about mold, about their son's respiratory health. They're sleeping on couches, and then with relatives, which means they don't have a stable place to put their kid down for a nap. Every single day is a negotiation with discomfort and uncertainty. And then on top of that, someone says, hey, you should also prepare a legal case, gather evidence, fill out court forms, and show up to argue in front of a judge. It's not just a cognitive load. It's almost insulting to suggest that someone in that situation should also become an amateur litigator.
The landlord knew that. That's the part that sticks with me. He's a lawyer. He didn't stumble into this strategy. He understood the asymmetry perfectly. If you don't sue me, I'll let this go. It's not a negotiation. It's a bet. He's betting that the cost of filing, time, emotional energy, uncertainty about court dates, exceeds whatever Daniel might recover. And for most tenants, even ones who would win, that bet pays off.
The lawyer part of this really gets under my skin, because it's not just that he's a landlord who happens to know some legal tricks. He's an officer of the court. He has professional ethical obligations. And he's using his specialized knowledge not to resolve a dispute fairly, but to extract a waiver from a family that's already been through the ringer. That feels like it should matter, but in practice, it doesn't. The Bar Association isn't going to sanction someone for using their deposit as leverage in a private negotiation.
The numbers bear this out in a way that's almost infuriating. Tenants who actually file small claims over deposit withholding win roughly 70-80% of cases where the landlord didn't provide itemized deductions. 70-80%. The law is fairly tenant-friendly on deposit issues, but fewer than 10% of tenants actually file. So you've got this enormous gap between legal merit and actual enforcement, and that gap is the landlord's entire business model.
Let's sit with that 10% number for a second, because I think it's easy to hear that and think, well, most tenants just don't know their rights. But that's not what's happening. A lot of tenants do know their rights. They've looked up the law. They've talked to a legal aid clinic. They know they'd win. And they still don't file. That's the part that should trouble us. Knowledge of rights is not the bottleneck. The bottleneck is the cost of exercising those rights.
That's what makes this different from, say, a consumer complaint where you can just do a credit card chargeback. There's no chargeback for a security deposit. There's no button you can press. The only enforcement mechanism is filing a case. And filing a case requires you to voluntarily re-enter a conflict you desperately want to be done with.
The individual decision makes perfect sense. But here's the problem, and I think this is what's eating at Daniel. When everyone makes that same rational decision, the system never gets corrected. Every tenant who signs a waiver rather than suing teaches the landlord that the strategy works. The expected cost of bad behavior drops to near zero.
This is a classic market failure. The costs are privatized. Daniel and Hannah absorb the air purifiers, the air conditioner cleaning, the emergency accommodation, the emotional aggravation. And the benefits are captured entirely by the landlord, who keeps the deposit, avoids repair costs, and faces no consequences. The landlord's expected gain from pulling this stunt is high, and his expected loss is almost nothing, because he knows the math on who actually files.
I want to put a finer point on the air purifier detail, because that's the kind of thing that sounds small but actually tells you everything. They bought air purifiers because the roof leak was causing mold and humidity issues. That's not a luxury purchase. That's a direct out-of-pocket cost caused by the landlord's failure to maintain the property, and then never getting that money back. Multiply that by every tenant this landlord has ever had, and you start to see the business model. He's not just saving money by not fixing things, he's actually transferring his maintenance costs onto his tenants, one air purifier at a time.
There's a second layer to this that I think Daniel was circling around when he mentioned wanting to create precedent. He wanted his case to matter beyond just recovering his own costs. And that instinct is admirable, but here's the misconception that needs busting. Small claims court decisions in almost every jurisdiction have zero precedential value. They bind only the parties in that specific case. You don't create legal precedent in small claims. To do that, you'd need to appeal to a higher court, which requires a lawyer, costs thousands of dollars, and takes years. The system is structurally designed to prevent individual tenant cases from changing the law.
Even the phrase, appeal to a higher court, makes it sound like a straightforward process. It's not. You don't just file an appeal and get a hearing. You need to identify a legal error in the lower court's ruling, which in small claims, where there's often no transcript and no formal findings of fact, is incredibly difficult. You need to hire an attorney who understands appellate procedure. You need to pay filing fees that can run into the thousands. And you need to wait. In some jurisdictions, the appellate backlog is 18 months or more. Who has 18 months to litigate a security deposit?
And it's one of those features of the legal system that looks neutral on paper but has a deeply asymmetric effect in practice. A landlord with a portfolio of properties can afford to appeal a case and create precedent that benefits landlords. A tenant with a one-off dispute cannot. So the body of precedent law accumulates in one direction over time, even if individual tenants keep winning in small claims.
Which means the "I'll create precedent" motivation, while noble, is also a trap. It sets you up to feel like you failed at something the system never actually allowed you to do. It's like feeling guilty that you didn't fly by flapping your arms. The mechanism was never there.
Let me put some concrete numbers on the asymmetry, because I think it helps to see the math. Small claims filing fees are typically $30 to $100. The time cost is 1 or 2 days in court. If the disputed amount is over $500, the expected value of filing, that's a 70% chance of winning multiplied by the amount, almost always exceeds the cost. The real barrier isn't financial, it's emotional. It's the exhaustion premium.
The exhaustion premium. That's the term we need, because moving is already brutal. You're physically depleted. You're financially stretched. Rents are up 18% since 2023 in a lot of markets. Vacancy rates under 2% in cities like Austin and Miami. And now someone's asking you to relitigate your trauma in a courtroom. Most people look at that and say, I'd rather pay the $500 to make this person go away forever.
That's not weakness. That's a rational cost-benefit analysis, where the cost side includes something the legal system refuses to price: your sanity, your family stability, your ability to be present for your one-year-old son. Daniel mentioned that he and Hannah made this decision together, and that detail matters. They weren't being cowardly, they were being parents.
There's a concept in behavioral economics called the hassle factor. It's the friction that prevents people from claiming benefits or exercising rights they're entitled to. Governments and companies sometimes deliberately increase the hassle factor to reduce uptake. The classic example is rebate programs. Companies know that a significant percentage of customers will never mail in the rebate form, even if the rebate is substantial. The hassle factor is doing the same work here. the landlord has created a hassle factor so high that even a winning case isn't worth pursuing.
The hassle factor isn't evenly distributed. A single parent working two jobs faces a much higher hassle factor than a retiree with free time. A family with a one-year-old faces a higher hassle factor than a couple without kids. The system disproportionately filters out the people who can least afford to lose their deposit.
The lawyer-landlord's explicit framing, "If you don't sue me, I'll let this go," is worth sitting with for a second, because it reveals the whole game. He's not saying, "I have a valid claim on your deposit." He's saying, "I have your money, and getting it back will cost you more than it's worth." That's not a legal argument. That's hostage, taking dressed up in a suit.
It's a documented pattern. Tenant advocacy organizations see this constantly. The security deposit becomes what one legal aid attorney I read called hostage capital. The landlord holds 1 or 2 months' rent, and even if the deductions are completely illegitimate, the tenant has to sue to recover it. That process takes months. The tenant has already moved. They have a new address, new bills, new commute. The landlord is counting on the friction being too high.
We've established that Daniel's decision was individually rational. But let's talk about the collective action problem, because that's where this gets properly bleak. Rental reform requires either legislative change, slow, politically difficult, or a critical mass of individual lawsuits that create enough judicial attention to pressure lawmakers, but individual tenants cannot coordinate with each other. They don't know each other. And each tenant's rational decision to settle undermines the collective case for reform. It's a tragedy of the commons, where the commons is accountability for bad landlords.
The landlord class understands this intuitively, even if they don't use the language of collective action problems. Every waiver signed is another data point confirming that the strategy works. The next tenant gets the same treatment, and the one after that. The landlord's behavior never changes because it never needs to.
This is the part where Daniel says he feels like he's let the side down. And I want to be really careful here, because that feeling is real and valid, but it's also misplaced. The side, the system of tenant protections, let him down. He didn't fail the system. The system failed him. The appropriate response isn't self-recrimination. It's channeling that frustration into something that actually changes the calculus for the next tenant.
Let's talk about what would actually change the calculus. Because this isn't just a venting session. There are concrete policy proposals that tenant advocacy researchers have been pushing for years, and they directly address the asymmetries we've been describing.
What actually works?
First, mandatory treble damages for bad faith withholding of security deposits. The idea is simple. If a landlord loses a deposit case, they pay 3 times the amount they withheld. That flips the expected value calculation. Suddenly, the landlord's downside is real, and tenants have a much stronger incentive to file because the potential recovery is meaningful. California Civil Code Section 1950.5 already allows for bad faith penalties, including treble damages in some cases, and it demonstrably changes landlord behavior.
You're not just getting your deposit back. You're getting a multiplier that makes the time investment worth it. And it's not just about the individual tenant's recovery. Treble damages change the landlord's calculus across their entire portfolio. If you own 20 units, and you're pulling this on every tenant, and suddenly even 1 or 2 of them file and win treble damages, your whole business model stops making sense. The risk spreads across all your properties.
The second proposal is automatic rent abatement for uninhabitable conditions. Right now, if your roof is leaking and your landlord won't fix it, you have to keep paying full rent and then sue to recover the overpayment later. That's backwards. Under an automatic abatement system, the tenant simply pays less rent until the issue is fixed, and the landlord has to sue the tenant to recover the difference. The burden of litigation shifts to the party with more resources.
Which is how it should be. If the landlord thinks the condition isn't serious enough to warrant reduced rent, let them make that case in court. Don't make the tenant pay full price for a unit with a collapsed ceiling, and then spend 6 months fighting to get the money back. That's like making someone pay full price for a meal, eating half of it, finding a cockroach in the salad, and then saying, "You can sue us for a refund later. You stop paying when the service isn't delivered."
The third one is a right to repair and deduct. California Civil Code Section 1942 already does this. Tenants can make urgent repairs themselves and deduct the cost from rent, capped at 1 month's rent, provided they give written notice first. New York has a similar provision. The key is that it doesn't require court involvement. The tenant identifies the problem, gets it fixed, and deducts. If the landlord disputes it, they can sue. But the repair happens first.
All three of these share the same logic. Reverse the burden. Make the landlord initiate legal action rather than the tenant. The party with more resources and more experience in the system should be the one who has to navigate it. It's the legal equivalent of making the polluter pay for the cleanup rather than making the victim sue for damages after the fact.
Notice what none of these proposals require. Tenants to be heroic. They don't require people to file lawsuits while unboxing their apartments and raising toddlers. They change the default setting so that the path of least resistance is also the path that holds landlords accountable.
That's the design principle that's missing from most rental markets. Right now, the path of least resistance is sign the waiver and move on. That's not an accident. That's a choice embedded in the legal architecture. And we can trace that choice back to specific legislative decisions. No one accidentally created a system where tenants have to sue to get their deposits back. Someone wrote that rule and someone else voted for it.
Let me add one more layer here because I think it connects to something Daniel said about wanting to create precedent. Even though small claims doesn't create legal precedent, there is such a thing as informational precedent. If you can't change the law, you can still warn the next tenant. There are tenant-facing platforms, the Bad Landlord Database, local tenant union blacklists, even just detailed Google reviews, where you can document what happened without relitigating your trauma. That's a low-effort way to contribute to the collective good.
A landlord who knows their name shows up on a tenant blacklist has a reputational cost they didn't have before. It's not treble damages, but it's not nothing. In tight rental markets, bad reviews actually affect vacancy rates. I've personally seen listings sit vacant for weeks longer than comparable units because the landlord had a trail of one-star reviews detailing deposit shenanigans. Word gets around.
The review doesn't have to be a novel. Landlord withheld deposit without itemized deductions, required threat of legal action to return partial amount. That's two sentences. It takes 60 seconds to write. And it tells the next potential tenant everything they need to know about what they're walking into.
The other thing about reviews is that they're harder to suppress than you might think. A landlord can't just get a bad review taken down because they don't like it. They'd have to prove it's defamatory, which means proving it's false. And if you're telling the truth, if you have the emails and the photos and the timeline, that review is staying up. It's one of the few forms of accountability that doesn't require a court order.
If I'm talking to Daniel or to anyone in this situation, here's what I'd say about the "Did I do the right thing?" question. You made a decision that prioritized your family's stability, your mental health, and your ability to be present for your son. That is not a moral failure. That is the correct hierarchy of values. The system is supposed to support people in enforcing their rights. It's not supposed to require people to sacrifice their well-being to do so.
The feeling of having let the side down. I get it. I genuinely do. But I think it's worth distinguishing between individual guilt and systemic responsibility. The fact that you feel guilty about not fighting is itself evidence that you care about rental reform. That guilt is a sign that you're the kind of person who would fight if the fight were winnable at a reasonable cost. The problem isn't your willingness, it's the cost.
Write to your local representative about rental reform. Support a tenant advocacy organization. Share your story, anonymized if you prefer, so that other people can recognize the pattern before they're in it. Daniel's been talking about this experience on the podcast for weeks, and that alone is a form of advocacy. He's already doing the thing.
He's not walking away silently. He's naming the pattern publicly. That's more than most people do, and it's valuable. Every time someone tells their story, it makes it a little bit harder for the next person to feel like they're the only one this has happened to. And that matters, because one of the most effective tools a bad landlord has is isolation, making each tenant feel like their situation is unique, like maybe they did something wrong, like they're the difficult ones. Stories break that isolation.
Let me give some practical advice for anyone who's in the middle of a rental dispute right now, because I think there are things you can do this week that change your position. First, document everything. Photos, emails, certified mail receipts. The single biggest predictor of winning a small claims case is having a paper trail. Even if you never file, documentation gives you leverage in settlement negotiations. The landlord who knows you, have time-stamped photos and a chain of emails refusing repairs, is a landlord who's more likely to offer a reasonable settlement.
On the documentation point, be specific about dates and times. Don't just say the roof was leaking. Say, on November 3rd, at 2 p.m., water began dripping from the ceiling in the nursery. I sent an email to the landlord at 2:15 p.m. with attached photos. He responded on November 7th, saying he would look into it. As of November 21st, no repair had been made. That level of specificity is much harder to dismiss in court than a general complaint about conditions.
Second, before you sign a mutual waiver, calculate the actual cost of filing. Filing fees are $30 to $100 in most jurisdictions. The time cost is 1 or 2 days. If the disputed amount is over $500, the expected value of filing, 70% chance of winning times the amount, almost always exceeds the cost. The barrier is emotional, not financial, and just recognizing that can help you make a clearer decision. You might still choose to settle, but at least you'll know what you're trading away.
I'd add, if you do the math and decide to file, many jurisdictions have small claims, advisory services that will help you fill out the forms for free. You don't need a lawyer. The whole system is designed to be accessible to people representing themselves. It's still a hassle, but it's not the same hassle as a full civil trial. The forms are simpler, the procedures are more relaxed, and judges are generally more patient with self-represented litigants.
Third, if you do settle, write the review. Tenant-facing platforms exist for exactly this reason. You can't create legal precedent, but you can create informational precedent. And for the next tenant scrolling through reviews at midnight trying to decide whether to sign a lease, your story might be the thing that saves them from the same nightmare.
The review is also cathartic. It's a way of saying, I see what you did, and I'm telling people, without having to spend 6 months in court to do it. There's a real psychological benefit to putting it out in the world, even if you never see the landlord's reaction. You're closing the loop on your own terms.
Let's pull back to the bigger question Daniel's story raises. What would it take to make the right choice? Pursuing a valid claim. Also the easy choice. Is that a matter of policy, or culture, or both?
I think it's mostly policy, honestly. Culture follows structure. If the structure makes it easy to hold landlords accountable, a culture of accountability develops. Right now, the structure makes it easy for landlords to exploit tenants and hard for tenants to fight back. That's not a culture problem. That's a design problem. You change the design, and the culture shifts to match. We've seen this in other areas. When seatbelt laws changed and enforcement increased, buckling up went from being a weird thing only safety nerds did to being automatic for almost everyone. The policy came first, then the norm.
I'd add that there's a cultural dimension to the guilt Daniel's feeling. We have this idea that if you don't fight, you're complicit. That's a useful norm in some contexts, but it breaks down when the fight is rigged. Telling someone they should have fought harder against a system designed to exhaust them is not moral clarity. It's victim blaming with extra steps.
The frame I keep coming back to is this. The landlord's strategy only works because the system allows it to work. The landlord isn't clever. He's just exploiting a gap that the law has left open. Closing that gap, through treble damages, automatic abatement, repair and deduct, is not a radical proposal. It's basic market correction. You're just making sure that the costs of bad behavior are borne by the person who chose to behave badly.
As remote work and housing costs continue to shift, more tenants are in precarious situations. The settle and move on pattern is going to intensify unless structural reforms change the incentives. Daniel's story is one data point in a much larger pattern, and that pattern is accelerating.
I want to close with something for Daniel directly, because he asked whether he did the right thing. Daniel, you and Anna made the best decision available to you under conditions you didn't choose. You protected your son's stability and your own mental health. That's not letting the side down. That's recognizing that the system, needs to be rebuilt so that the next family in your position doesn't face the same impossible choice. The guilt you're feeling is misdirected. Aim it at the people who designed the rules, not at yourself for navigating them as best you could.
If you've had a similar experience, or if you've actually taken a landlord to small claims and won, we want to hear from you. Go to myweirdprompts.com and leave us a voice memo. Your story might be the thing that changes someone else's calculation. That's not legal precedent, but it's something.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1900s, a small community of Cantonese-speaking immigrants in Belize preserved a tonal distinction between high-rising and low-falling tones that had already merged in most other diaspora communities, making their speech a surviving artifact of an older stage of the language.
I don't know what to do with that.
That'll keep me up tonight. I'm going to be lying in bed at 2 a.m, thinking about high-rising tones in Belize, and wondering what else we've lost without knowing it.
This has been My Weird Prompts. If you want to support the show, head to myweirdprompts.com and leave us a review. We read everyone, and honestly, they help more than you'd think.
I'm Corn.
I'm Herman Poppleberry. We'll see you next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.